जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी, गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी, गोपी जन शौद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, जमुना तीरा वनचारी, जमुना तीरा वनचारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी, गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, जमुना तीरा वनचारी, जमुना तीरा वनचारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज का चय स्तोत्र सच सी सीमा रीति भक्ति वेदांत स्वाम प्रभुपाद की जय। इस्कॉन फाउंडर आचार्य श्री प्रभुपाद की जय। जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज का चय स्तोत्र सच सी सीमा भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर की जय। नंद गौरी वैष्णव वृंद की जय। नामाचार्य श्रील हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद द्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गोगोपीनाथ श्याम कुंद राधा कुंद गिरि गोवर्धन की जय। वृंदावन धाम की जय। मायापुर धाम की जय। जगन्नाथ स्वामी की जय। गंगा मई की जय। यमुना मई की जय। तुलसी देवी की जय। भक्ति देवी की जय। समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। ऑल ग्लोरीज ऑफ द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज। गौर प्रेमानंदे हरि हरि बोल। सो I had the pleasure of being given the wrong Bhagavatam verse for today. So this is going to be very spontaneous. That's all right. Everything that Krishna does is good. So, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Dhanam. Oh, okay. I still have the wrong verse. So this is, quote the Beatles, it's getting better all the time. So, okay, I give up. What verse number is that? What? Oh, 18. Okay, 1518. Well, 11.5.18.Bhagavatam. Okay. So the third time's a charm, right? Oh, okay, here we go. Itwa Atma Maya Rachita. Anyway, this is going to be interesting. Griha Apatya Suhit Striyaha Tamo Vishanti Anichanto Vasudeva Paranmukha Hitvatma Maya Rachita Vihapatya Suhit Striya Tamo Vishantini Chanto Vasudeva Parangmukha Hitatma Maya Rachita Vihapatya Suhit Striya Tamo Vishantini Chanto Vasudeva Paranmukha. So, do you guys chant or? Ladies? So, translation, hitwa means giving up, atmamaya by the illusory energy of the Supreme Soul, rachita, manufactured, griha, homes, apatya, children, srit, friends, striya, wives, tama, into darkness, vishanti, they enter, anichanto, without desiring, vasudeva, parakmukha, those who have turned away from Lord Vasudeva. So, the translation, those who have turned away from the Supreme Lord Vasudeva, being under the spell of the Lord's illusory energy, are eventually forced to give up their so-called homes, children, friends, wives, and lovers, which were all created by the illusory potency of the Supreme Lord, and enter against their will into the darkest regions of the universe. Okay. Purport, the living entity turns his back on the Supreme Personality of Godhead and tries instead to enjoy temporary sense gratification. The result is simple anxiety as the conditioned soul struggles to maintain his temporary wife, children, friends, home, nation, etc. Finally, all of these things are taken away, and the bewildered soul, in great frustration, sometimes tries to take shelter of an impersonal concept of God and liberation. Thus, the conditioned soul is always in ignorance, either in pursuing illusory sense gratification or trying to avoid sense gratification by merging into the impersonal aspect of the Lord called Brahman. But the actual position of the living entity is to serve the Supreme Person who is his master. And unless one gives up one's inimical feelings toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there's no question of peace or happiness. And then finally, there's a quotation from the Madhya Lila. Krishna Bhakta Nishkam, a devotee of Krishna, Krishna Bhakta Nishkam has no material desire. Ataeva, therefore, Shanta is peaceful. Bhukti Mukti Siddhi Kami, one who desires bhukti, sense gratification, mukti, liberation, siddhi, some kind of mystic perfection. Sakali, all such people, Ashanta, are not peaceful. And of course, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Ashanta Sikhutak Sukham, where is the happiness for one who is not peaceful? So, let's see if I can make all my points and still remarkably stick to the verse. So, Hitvatva Maya Rachita. So, the first point is that, Griha Patya Suhrit Striya. Griha, home, Apatya, children, Suhrit, well-wishers, Striya, literally just women. So, obviously, this verse is speaking from the man's point of view. And so this verse, in a sense, is talking about a man who's practicing self-realization. And obviously, we know women also practice self-realization. In agrarian societies, which this was, I mean, the Vedic culture was extended families, it was often a patriarchal society. And therefore, you find verses addressing men because, in a sense, the fate of the family rested with the decisions of those elders. Interesting. Well, anyway, that's also for the same reason that actually... That also explains, by the way, why Paul was the first person to have success in reaching Gentiles, but... Because in a male-dominated society in Israel, family wouldn't take to Christianity unless the men did, and because the stakes for conversion, Judaism was quite high, the man had to be circumcised, which is a little scary when you're an adult. And anyway, so it's the same general principle here addressing the Roman society also, they had what, if you look at the sociology of Roman society, the head of the family is called pater familias. The family father, so to speak, and there's a whole sociological structure. Anyway, that was just the reality of the way the world was. So here, hitvatva maya rachita. So these things, and of course for the woman, you could throw in the man and talk about. But the idea is that all these material things are rachita, which means manufactured, fabricated, built, constructed, by the Lord's illusory energy. And it's interesting, the word Atma is just a simple Sanskrit word, self. And so it can mean, self can here mean the Supreme Self, the Paramatma. And can also, it's also used as the, possessive pronoun in a sense, like Atma Maya, one's own Maya, like the self's Maya. And so it can mean one's personal Maya, because everyone has our own custom illusion. Based on the choices we've made, every one of us is struggling against our own particular attachments and aversions. And of course, attachments and aversions by definition are illusion, because there's nothing really in this world that we can logically or rationally be attached to. So we are irrationally attached or averse. And so it's interesting, because if I could sneak in one of my preaching points here. If you look at the Bhagavad Gita or Bhagavatam or all of our Vaishnava literature, there is always a tension between or a contrast between equality and hierarchy. And this is a creative tension. It's not a conflict. It's not a contradiction. It's not even a paradox. I mean, Heraclitus, the pre-Socratic philosopher, gave the example of a bow, like for arrows, a bow that's been strung. He said, if you look at the bow, it looks like it's at rest, but actually there's a tension between the two sides of the bow. And it's precisely that tension which gives the power to the bow, so you can shoot an arrow. And so there are creative tensions, which are not contradictions, it's not hypocrisy, it's just, they're just different aspects of the world. For one thing, because all of us in this world have a tension between the fact that we are eternal souls and we are in human bodies. That's simply a fact. And both those facts are real. The human fact is temporarily real, but it's nonetheless real. And that's why the Upanishad, for example, says, vidyang cha jastad vedo bhayang saha. One who knows both. One who knows both. Vidya, the word avidya, which literally means ignorance, is just a jargon in philosophical Sanskrit for the material world. It's just called the ignorance. So, and the opposite, of course, is vidya, real knowledge, which is the spiritual platform. And you have to know both. I mean, the Upanishad makes this very striking statement, avidyaya mrityum tirtva, which literally means one transcends, one crosses over death by ignorance. But of course, that's not really what it means. It means by knowledge of the material world. Know thyself. And specifically, and this is very interesting, the Upanishad is saying, in order to achieve self-realization, you have to really understand yourself, not only as a soul, but as a human being. And if, as in the good old days, you know, in a neophyte position, one can deny one's human condition and think, well, since I'm an eternal soul, you know, damn the human condition, I'm just going to surrender, which is a nice thought, but it leads to all kinds of psychological, not to speak of financial complications. So, of course, so in this Upanishad verse, avidyaya mrityum tirtva, crossing over death by avidya, by understanding this world, and then vidyaya, by spiritual knowledge, amritam ashnute, one enjoys immortality. So it's interesting, if you analyze these two lines, you see that knowledge of this world, in a sense, performs a negative function. Knowledge of this world allows you to transcend it. It's like if you go to, let's say, to give a crude example, some guy or girl goes to a party and looks around, there's no one interesting, so you transcend the party by realizing there's nothing there worth investigating. Or if you go shopping and, no, I don't like anything here, so you transcend that store. So in the same way, after basically we spent the last several million lives on a shopping spree in the material world trying to find something that, you know, that fits, that feels good. I really look good in this, and we haven't found anything. So when we really understand the material world, then we transcend it. But merely crossing over death or the material world doesn't necessarily mean that you're attached to the higher truth. You just, for example, one can become a nihilist. One can become simply say, as some so-called philosophers did, especially in the 20th century and in all centuries, that there's nothing happening in this world and there's nothing else, so I might as well just be miserable. Or I might as well, or maybe I should kill myself, or maybe I should just go up in a mountain and, I don't know, do whatever people do on the tops of mountains. So therefore, the Upanishad says we have to not only realize that there's nothing here for us in this world, we also have to understand what really is worth the trouble, what really is meaningful and beautiful, which is the spiritual platform. So there's that negative and positive function. So what does it mean to understand yourself, to understand this world? I mean, there's, and of course we know in the Vedic Shastras, two ways to get that knowledge. One is nivritti, you kind of just figure it out. Like, even though my mind and body may be attracted to that, but I can see that's not going to take me to a good place. That's not going to take me to a good place, so I think I'll pass on that particular sense gratification or that attachment, or that aversion. One, for example, may feel hatred. You know, human beings are constantly annoying each other, which is one of the most remarkable features of this world. And so there's always this temptation to hate someone. And so one can realize, no, I don't think I'll go down that road because it's just going to lead to my own suffering and all kinds of trouble. So at the same time, there are certain activities, objects, experiences, emotions in the material world that we may intellectually realize that's not really my supreme good, but the attachment's too strong or the aversion is too strong. And so that takes us to plan B, which is pravritti marg, which the marga, of course, means path or road. So it means that one has to engage certain experiences, certain objects. For example, grihastha life is generally taken to be pravritti marg, where it's not, let's say, psychologically and therefore not spiritually healthy to renounce something that one is not ready to renounce, and so therefore one engages that, but in the spirit of eventually transcending it. Not necessarily transcending the people. That's another very important point. Like in this little list here, griha, one's home and children, it doesn't mean that one rejects those people. It doesn't mean you hate those people or, you know, you just spend the rest of your life spitting at the thought of them. That's one of those great verses, you know. What's interesting in the classic spitting verse, which is that Kula Shekharacharya or Jamunacharya? Jamunacharya. Please note, he's not spitting at the women. Which sometimes people don't realize. What he's actually spitting at is his own stupidity. His own attachments. He's not dishonoring women. He's not saying that women were bad or it's their fault. He's saying, I was a fool because I tried to exploit women. He's spitting at his desire to exploit women. He's not spitting at the women. So that's just a little linguistic clarification there. So here we are in our human condition, and so getting back to my other point, because we are in human bodies and they're real, and that's why Krishna says in the Gita, Krishna warns us in the Gita, don't try to be too austere. In other words, he says, don't eat too much or too little. Don't sleep too much or too little. And then he says, of course, by extension, this refers to all activities. It refers to our, not only our physical needs, it refers to our emotional needs. Because, for example, marriage is not only about physical needs. It's not just like, you know, the old caveman trying to satisfy himself. It's also about emotional needs, about the need for friendship, the need for companionship, and all these things. And Krishna warns us in the Gita that not too much or too little. And so if you say, okay, what's the sweet spot? What's not too much and not too little? It's exactly analogous to, let's say, going to a gym to work out the body and having a personal trainer has to find out, okay, you can lift 20 pounds, don't lift 30, don't lift 10. 10, no benefit. 30, you'll hurt yourself. And so in that sense, a spiritual teacher, mentor, guru, whatever, is supposed to be like a spiritual personal coach or personal trainer. And a good spiritual workout is exactly like a good physical workout. You have to find... You know, it's like in yoga classes, they always say, you know, you're not competing with the person next to you. Just find, you know, how far you can stretch. How do I know that? Because, anyway, so you're never supposed to ask that question when a sannyasi gives class. So we have our human condition. And then we have the ultimate, our ultimate identity. We really are eternal souls. That's actually who we are. And yet, we're very much engaged and very much involved in this human condition. And therefore, the Vedic culture addresses these two realities. Because you can't dismiss one of them. You can't just say, okay, I'm just going to be real, you know, and just satisfy my human needs and basically ignore the fact that I'm an eternal soul. which, you know, some people have tried. And then on the other hand, you can't just be so spiritual that you ignore the fact that you really do have a body and it really does affect you. So the Vedic culture deals with this tension in a very simple way. There's hierarchy. There's a whole, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Chatur Varnya Maya Sistram, Sristam, I've created the Varna system. And so Varnashram is very much coming from Krishna. It's in the oldest Vedic literature that we have. In the Rig Veda, which is, by linguistic analysis, the oldest Sanskrit literature, and it's right there, Book 10 of the Rig Veda, the universal form, the different social orders are mapped onto the sort of symbolic universal form of the Lord. So that's very much Vedic. The whole Varnashram system is Vedic, and it's hierarchical. The Bhagavatam also describes the Varnashram system and also maps it onto the body of the universal form of the Lord. And interestingly, actually, Grihasthas are above Brahmacharis. That was interesting. I mean, it's just because of, you know, the Vedic culture is like real human beings. Just like, you know, when some young guy or some your son or daughter gets married, everyone celebrates, we're having a wedding and all that. It was actually like that. And so the Brahmacharis are the feet of the universal form, or feet of the legs, and the waist is the householders, which fortunately means they get to pay for everything. Which is, of course, makes all the other ashrams very happy. So, because they're the waist. And so it's just like you have the Shudras, and then the Vaishyas, and the Kshatriyas, and the Brahmanas. So you have the Brahmacharis, the householders, the Vanaprastas, and the Sannyasis. That's hierarchical. It's a hierarchical system. There are other hierarchies which are natural. For example, parents and children, up to a certain age. You know, at a certain age, you know, it's kind of reverses. It's a, no, come on, Dad, you got to eat your soup. Go, so... But at least in the first part of life, parents have to govern their children. It's not a democracy. And that's natural, or you could say teachers and students. And so there's all kinds of relationships, there's all kinds of, or governments and subjects, where the government has to establish fair, reasonable laws and then enforce them in a reasonable, fair manner. It's interesting, if you study justice, either within the Dharma Shastras in Sanskrit or even within the Western tradition, I mean, actually everyone in the Western tradition was not a complete moron, contrary to what some people think. And Krishna actually explains in the Bhagavad Gita that knowledge comes from the mode of goodness. And we find throughout the world there have been good people throughout the world. I mean, if you don't believe it, study history. You know, there have been good, decent, sincere, pious people all over the world throughout history. And according to Bhagavad Gita, they got knowledge. They didn't get the highest theology. That you have to get from Krishna through disciplic succession. But in terms of general wisdom, how to lead a good life and how to lead a healthy life, how to treat other people, even the importance of virtue, that you find not everywhere in terms of everyone, but throughout the world, throughout history, you find wise people that understood this. And Krishna explains why. So there are hierarchies which are natural, which cannot be removed. In fact, there's a tendency throughout history, at least in Western history, you find it in the great English, well, the horrible English Civil War of 1640, you find the French Revolution, is called the leveling tendency. The idea that even among human beings, you can just level everything, no hierarchies. And of course, this is because of the social and political pendulum effect, that whenever you have societies that are oppressive, where the people have power, either because of physical power in a warrior society, or because they have money, or for whatever reason, they have power, and they use that power to oppress other people, you get this pendulum effect. It goes to the opposite extreme, and you get what's called, you know, this leveling tendency, just to level, bring down all hierarchies. And of course, both these extremes are dangerous and unnatural and not sustainable. So there is natural hierarchy in Vedic culture, and then there is the fact that we're all equal. And equality is a big deal in the Bhagavad Gita for those who have actually purchased my books, and lower prices are available if you purchase in volume. And actually, the rest of this class is going to be an infomercial. Anyway, one of the points that I discovered when I was going through the Gita very carefully, writing the book, is how much Krishna emphasizes equality. It's interesting because nowadays, in the modern world, equality, of course, is a very central point. And just to give you a few verses I just noted down, fearing the effects of age on me in this class, I noted down a few things. For example, Krishna says, he says, Maya tatamidam sarvam, that I pervade, whoops, wrong set of verses, sorry. Okay, the equality verses, I know them. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 247 defines yoga as equality. Krishna says, samatvam, sama means same, equal in Sanskrit. And just like Sindhu Hindu, the S, what you find is a Sanskrit S tended to be pronounced as an H in ancient Persian. So you get Sindhu Hindu. And then the Greeks did not pronounce an H at the beginning of a word, so it got dropped. Anyway, but so you get the word sama, which became in Greek homo. That's what the prefix homo, a homogenesis. I mean, you can fill in your own word after homo. So, but homo means the same. So the Greek homo is just Sanskrit sama. So sama twang means sameness, equality, equalness. And Krishna says that yoga is defined. Yoga is defined as equality. Krishna says, panditasama darshana, that the wise see all creatures equal. And Krishna gives a really wide spectrum here because he says, vidya vinaya sampane. First he says, a brahmana, and not just like sort of a hypocritical brahman, a brahman in name only. So Krishna wants to really emphasize, we're talking about a real brahman. So therefore, he says, one who is endowed with knowledge, a learned Brahman, and humility. Of course, humility has always been my strong point. So Krishna says, vidya vinaya sampane, a Brahman who's endowed with knowledge and humility. And then the opposite. So you have vidya, brahmane, gavi, a cow, hastini, an elephant. And then Shuni, a dog, and a dog eater. Shuni, Chaiva, Shopa, literally a dog cooker. That's what it literally means. So Shuni, Chaiva, we can assume that even the lowest class people didn't eat raw dog. So Shuni, Chaiva, Shopa, Kecha. So this is the whole spectrum. You know, the highest Brahman, the highest human being, the lowest human being. So one who sees all these equal, I mean, obviously to see all them equally didn't mean that a wise person rejects the hierarchy. Because in fact, for example, in our temple, we have Brahmins worship the deity. We don't have dog cookers worship the deity, at least no one that we know. I mean, we assume that. So, but Krishna says the wise still. And the very fact that Krishna mentions these very different people, the first-class Brahman, the dog cooker, the dog, because Krishna knows that these things are really different. And yet, you see things that are different equally. It would have no philosophical impact if Krishna said, one who sees gold and gold as equal, one who sees Brahmins and Brahmins as equal. It's like, well, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. So the whole impact of Krishna's statement is that he's purposely taking objects that everyone knows, including Krishna, are very different. And yet the difference is superficial in the literal sense of the word, because superficie in Latin means the surface. The surface. On the surface, these people and creatures are different. Beneath the surface, they're actually equal. And so Krishna says, for example, Samohang, I am equal. Samohang, Sarva Bhuteshu, to all beings, all creatures. And then Krishna says, you'd better be too. if you want to understand Krishna consciousness. He says about devotees, samak sarveshu bhuteshu, same language. Samoham sarvabhuteshu, samak sarveshu bhuteshu. One who is equal to all living beings, samak sarveshu bhuteshu, mad bhakti, my devotion to me, labhate, one achieves, param, the highest. So to achieve the highest devotion, one has to see all living beings equally. So now in a society, you can actually measure to what extent a society, even a religious society, is spiritual by seeing what do they emphasize. Is the hierarchy what really matters? I mean, I'm not saying that you don't have a hierarchy, but in terms of the culture, in terms of the way people treat each other and the way people see each other, is hierarchy really what dominates the society? Or is it the fact that everyone treats everyone else with respect? That everyone respects everyone else? Is it a society in which, for example, you have men that think they're better than women because they're on the bodily platform? Or is it a society in which people understand that, for example, men aren't going to have babies and, you know, women may not go to war? I mean, there are a few women that go to war, but mostly men. So, in other words, there are differences. Science studies that if we want to know the difference between men and women, there's a whole huge field of reliable social science which talks about this. But anyway, so it's not a question of pretending that children and parents are the same or that, you know, it's a question of seeing beyond the superficial difference and seeing that actually everyone is equal, and the equality is what's really important. To give an example, take parents and children. The parents, superficially, but I mean actually, are in charge. The parents have to govern the family. And yet, good parents never think they're more important than their children. It's exactly the opposite. Good parents think their children are more important, and therefore they will give their lives for their children. And they do give their lives in the sense of working hard and just doing everything within their power for their children, out of love. So, if parents actually think we're more important than our children, then you have very bad parents. And there are parents like that, who put their own sense gratification ahead of the welfare of their children. And they're the worst parents, and they're actually unfit to be parents. So in the same way, if someone is a guru or a sannyasi and actually thinks that I'm more important, I'm really better than my disciples, or I'm better than other devotees, that's called the bodily concept of life. And so you can have a situation where a person in the bodily concept of life exploits the Vedic hierarchy not to serve other people, but to lord it over them. Actually, Lord Chaitanya talks about this. He gives the analogy in terms of our individual spiritual practice of the garden and the gardener, the seed. You get the seed of bhakti planted in the heart, which is compared to a garden. And therefore, you have to take care of your garden, because weeding is a perennial activity. There's no once and for all weeding, although don't tell Monsanto that. But weeding is something that has to go on all the time. And so, obviously, weeds grow not only in the individual heart or garden. There are community weeds. There are social weeds, because people influence each other. And you can have a healthy society or a sick society, just like you can have an individual that's spiritually healthy or spiritually sick. And therefore, individually in our own spiritual life, we should be very vigilant to keep our garden free of weeds. And as a society, we should be very vigilant to make sure that we don't develop wrong attitudes or just... it's just a duty. It's a duty. And Prabhupada was very vigilant. Prabhupada was very vigilant for his society, And vigilant doesn't mean offensive. It doesn't mean you go around insulting everyone. It doesn't mean license to just criticize whoever you want. It simply means that as a society, we should talk to each other. We should be vigilant and make sure that our society is always tilted toward the spiritual side, in which we see and respect hierarchies. We don't obliterate them, but at the same time, the real atmosphere in ISKCON, the real culture of ISKCON, is that everyone respects everyone else, sincerely respects everyone else, and we don't see people as their bodies. In fact, I would say the first qualification for a leader is not to think you're better than other people. And the first disqualification is to think that you're really better than other people. Again, parents don't give up their duties as parents. They do take care of their children. They do make decisions. They do make their children eat their vegetable prasadam. But in their hearts, they're doing all that because they see their children as more important. And that's exactly the mood of a manager or a king, according to the Bhagavatam. It's like a loving father. Ramchandra was like a loving father. Yudhisthira was like a loving father, which means they saw the citizens as more important. In fact, so that's what it means to be a spiritual society, actually. So, any questions? There was a sign. I should leave time for questions. I mean, yes, go ahead.
The verse that you quote, which is Pandita Samadarsin. So as I heard from you, you said, underneath the surface, there is a qualitatively, we respecting all of them as a soul, so there is a one more focus to be on that point.
Yes.
But from the principle of utility is the principle, Prabhupada says, that I will give probably more importance to Gobi when I need to offer something to the Lord, not to the dog or dog eater. So apparently it will be always...
I made that point, that we preserve hierarchies, that they have to be respected, that there are natural hierarchies. However, at the same time, we have spiritual vision.
So there will be difference.
I think I said that several times.
Okay.
Yes.
Very nice, Maharaj. Basically, this society of respect is a Madhyama Vaishnava platform, but that can't be artificially achieved. It's something that comes about as a result of realization. So about the vigilance should have in kind of detecting when collectively we may get off the mark, but what do you do? It's either, I guess stressing spiritual practices, because that's how the Madhya...
I would say we need to practice sadhana civility. Sadhana civility. Okay. I will explain. I first said it and then paused to let the suspense increase. And now I will reveal my intention. For example, I mean, the whole point of sadhana bhakti is, no, I'm not swimming in the ocean of ecstatic love for Krishna, but yes, I still have to get up in the morning. Or I still chant my rounds. No, I'm not, seeing Krishna everywhere, but yes, I do have to chant. And so the point is that if you understand, if you really understand that you must respect everyone, then you practice. That's what Aristotle says it, Rupa Goswami says it, and most importantly, Jane Austen says it. So, well, in the case of Aristotle, obviously we'll give preference to the man here. So in the case of Aristotle, Aristotle wrote one very famous book on ethics called the Nicomachean Ethics. And how you achieve excellence as a human being. And he said that basically practice makes perfect. that you have to behave in an ethical way, and then it becomes your second nature. So, in other words, we have to create a society in which it is simply not permissible to mistreat people. Because otherwise we don't want to become that just one more historical example of religious hypocrites. I mean, there's a reason why in the present society there's this extremely popular dichotomy where people say, well, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, or yeah, I want to be spiritual, but I'm not into religion. Why aren't people joining religious institutions? I mean, there are many historical reasons you could give to study the whole trajectory of Western and, say, world history in the last 500, 700 years, whatever. But one reason is that religious institutions, I'm not talking about ISKCON here, I'm just making a general historical remark. I think one could make a strong argument have been perhaps the most productive institution for hypocrisy. It's hard to find any other type of human institution, you know, social, military, cultural. It's hard to find any other human institution which has been such a powerful source of hypocrisy as religious institutions. And it's gotten to a time in human history where people have just like had enough. And so if we, you know, I mean, for example, ISKCON can't be a place where you are your body, you're not your body, but you are your clothes. Or if you're a man, you're not your body, but if you're a woman, you may be your body. You know, it can't be an institution where people that hold high positions, whether it's guru or, you know, sannyasi or GBC or whatever, you know, whatever high position, actually believe they're better than other people and treat people as if those people are somehow inferior. And so, I mean, in other words, the world is up to here with religious hypocrisy. And so the purpose of ISKCON is not to be, you know, so to speak, make the rubble bounce in terms of respect for religious institutions or the last nail in the coffin of religion on earth. ISKCON is supposed to change that. ISKCON is supposed to reestablish, restore faith in spirituality. ISKCON is supposed to restore faith in religious institutions, not confirm what everyone feared about religious institutions. And it's not easy. You know, it's not that, as we know, Rupa Goswami warns us that don't think that just because you get up early or chant your rounds, that therefore you're a model of spirituality. You may be, but you aren't necessarily. You know, there's this, and what Rupa, in fact, Rupa Goswami says, if you think, or if I think, or if any of us think, that just by following rules we are great souls, he says that will destroy bhakti. It's what I call bhakti mimamsa, just like there's karma mimamsa. It's a type of mechanical approach to devotion that you kind of master bhakti yoga. So people will judge us, and they have every right to judge us by our real behavior, how we treat each other, how we treat them, how we treat women, how we treat children. They have every right to judge us, and they have every right to call us hypocrites if they don't find among us the highest spiritual standard of behavior, of relationships, of human relationships, then they have every right to call us hypocrites and to continue in their conviction that religious institutions are not the way. In fact, the most radical person, I'm not radical, I'm actually, if you want a real radical on this subject, read Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I'm serious. I mean, he's radical. And he's a pure devotee. So, I mean, I'm very hopeful. That's why I'm a member of ISKCON, because I'm not a foolish little, you know, Prabhupada wannabe where I'm going to start something else. And I'm not so naive that I think that without a religious institution, you can actually help the world. It's just not the nature of history. I mean, human beings have to organize in order to... It's funny, there's these like these fools that write books about how, you know, don't trust authority, except me, in my book. And we don't need religious institutions, but without organization and society, societal institutions, who printed their book? Who edited your book? You know, who distributes your book, you fool? So the idea is that human beings are, by nature, individual and social. They are private and public. We are both. That's the beta of beta. We are individual beings. We are social beings. We're private. We're public. And therefore, history shows it's simply not possible to spread spiritual knowledge without a spiritual institution. And any human institution will have its share of silliness. But still, we have to work. That's what, you know, we have to work for Prabhupada. That's what Prabhupada told us. If you see problems in ISKCON, then fix it. And that's what I'm trying to do personally, because I know that's my duty to Prabhupada. So anyway, any last question before the hook comes up? Oh, a lady back there? Oh, I was going to... Oh, okay, thank you. He's a plant. One of the things I really like about Jane Austen is, one of the things, is that in the culture she describes or she depicts, no matter what mood you're in, you have to be a lady or a gentleman. You may despise someone, you may not feel like it, you may be angry, but you still have to have good manners. It's not superficial. It's based on your duty to God. They're not superficial novels of manners. Because actually, for example, if someone breaks this code and does not behave properly, as in one particular book, and then when that person who's one of the heroines corrects herself, she realizes that actually I did not do my duty to God. It was my duty to God to respect everyone. So it's Sense and Sensibility, Marianne Dashwood. So, so that's sadhana, being a civilized human being, practicing being a civilized human being, not to speak of an advanced devotee. So, back there, yes.
Hare Krishna.
Yes.
There are two things that we have to consider. First of all, it's very difficult to legislate in any way humility and pride. So it seems to me that that's the real difficulty, not even in only religious organizations, but in political organizations and all kinds of organizations, that pride is something that is very difficult it has to be worked on. So through our philosophy, Bhagavad Gita, chanting Hare Krishna and humble state of mind, this is how we understand what is pride and what is humility.
Yes.
That seems to be a foundational discrepancy.
Of course.
Understand.
Okay, good point. I will say two things in reply. Anyway, can't help it. You know that joke, the Roman walks into the bar and says, give me five. Anyway, sorry. So getting back to your question. On the one hand, the Vedic system is created in such a way that brahmanas, especially brahmanas, and they may be sannyasis, maybe be grihastas or brahmacharis or brahmacharinis, they're supposed to teach, especially sannyasis and grihasta brahmins, are supposed to teach the society. It gets into this old Greek distinction in classical Greek culture between physis and nomos. In other words, what things should actually be legislated, what things should be left to good customs. But also, how should I put it? The leaders, whether it's a sannyasi or a guru or a GBC or a temple president, leaders have to set the example. Because yajadacharti shrestha. And in that sense, I think a spiritual society should, or leaders should, hold themselves to a higher standard, not a lower standard. I won't go into that whole point, but so if we as leaders have to set the example that we understand that we're all equal, that's the point I wanted to make. You know, it doesn't matter if someone's a sannyasi, a grihasta, or an unmarried man or woman. It doesn't matter, you know, it certainly doesn't matter what gender someone is. There's a certain universal human condition. Obviously, as we all know, at different stages of our own life, we go through different challenges. We know that men and women in some ways have distinct natures, and so on and so forth. But beyond all those differences, there's a certain basic human condition that we're all in. And every one of us, regardless of what kind of body we have, regardless of what position we have, all of us are struggling in that human condition and have similar challenges at different stages of our lives. So, I mean, you raise a very good question. You know, how in practical terms, how do we actually... I would say that Prabhupada came to start a Brahminical society. And anyway, Hare Krishna. So Prabhupada came to start a Brahminical society, and those who are able, willing and able, should speak. In the paper I wrote about ISKCON governance, it's called public reason. Public reason is sort of an academic term, which means that in a healthy society, good citizens of that society, especially people who know what they're talking about, who actually are thoughtful, have to discuss among themselves. That's what Prabhupada wanted. When Prabhupada invoked the first annual Mayapur GBC meeting in a letter he wrote to Kirtananda in 1973, and before that, the GBC would just meet from time to time, whenever Prabhupada would call them, either Los Angeles or New York or wherever. And so in a letter, in November 1973, Prabhupada said, from now on, there's going to be an annual meeting every year in Mayapur around the time of Gaur Purnima. And in that letter, Prabhupada said that the GBC and the senior devotees should meet and discuss. In other words, Prabhupada's vision when he invoked that first meeting was that there has to be a type of meeting of elders. So, and frankly, someone can also be an elder by their wisdom. I know that I have some disciples who are very smart and wise. And so wisdom is wisdom wherever you find it. So I'm doing my part. That's what I can do as a member of ISKCON. I can speak out and try to encourage others to think about and promote these ideas. Yes? You? Hare Krishna, Raghavan. We're almost out of time. We are out of time, so... In two more minutes, actually, if this, something opens up and I fall through, that will be your indication that the class is over.
So thanks for the wonderful class. And I'm just wondering, my Guru Maharaj, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he had the idea that sometimes we would, the manager would rotate services because that would give each other appreciation for the other services that other...
Very interesting idea, and one I will not... talk about in this class.
Okay.
Because that's sort of a managerial thing.
Right.
That's not what I'm being paid for right now.
Okay, I bought a copy of your book. Thank you.
So, anything else? Sure. Check, credit, or gold coins. Yes, Vishal, maybe last question. Yes.
Simply wonderful class, Maharaj. You mentioned one who eats too much or too little, and then pravritti marg and nivritti marg. Now, I wonder in the case of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, did he emphasize more nivritti marg?
Prabhupada emphasized Krishna consciousness. The best ashram is the one that works for you. And Prabhupada just said, you know, basically get her done. You know, it's, in other words, be Krishna conscious. Prabhupada was strikingly pragmatic, and he just wanted to get the job done. So whatever ashram works for you, that's the best ashram for you. And everyone has an equal opportunity to serve Krishna. Everyone is just an end. Everyone can have, if you're sincere, your Rudolph moment. You know, then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say. And it really, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, for those who are culturally deprived. So the idea is, it does not matter what kind of body you have. It doesn't matter, you know, how old you are. It doesn't matter if you're male or female or grihastha or sannyasi. It's actually irrelevant in terms of your free opportunity to surrender to Krishna and become greatly empowered. I started my own little nefarious program, Krishna West, and I'm actually happy to say that practically half the leaders are women. I mean, or more than half. I mean, but there's basically what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita is that your duty is born of your nature. Your duty is born of your nature. And that means if someone is able to do something, if it's their nature to do a particular service, whatever kind of body they have, then that is their duty. And to deny any soul the right to serve Krishna according to their abilities and according to their nature is to do violence. And so in the name of protecting groups like women, we should not commit violence against them. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, it's very dangerous not to do your own natural duty. And so to prevent anyone, man or woman, young or old, to prevent someone from doing their natural duty is actually to act against Krishna, to act against that person's salvation. And so the real, it's a very simple thing. A particular devotee either can or cannot perform a particular service. And so we don't need to be in fear that if we give certain responsibilities, say to women, then you know the whole world may collapse and the next thing we know, Kalki's here and we failed. So it's very simple that a man or a woman either can or cannot do the duty. And do the duty means perform the duty competently and also maintain their own moral and spiritual principles. That's part of doing the duty. And so we should be very careful about exploiting so-called Vedic culture to lord it over other people and to do violence to other devotees by preventing them from using all of their abilities in Krishna service. So we'll end there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.